today we're going to be into 2 Peter chapter 2. And I'm in Zechariah. That's not going to work. 2 Peter chapter 2. There we go. I got it now. Well, in the last session, we saw holy men of God that were moved by the Holy Spirit of God writing to the believers messages to be taken to heart, something that we should pay attention to. As we've heard in the sermon today and sermons in the past and previous Bible studies, there's a lot of warnings that are coming out of 2 Peter, 1 Peter, and John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, even when we get into that. In this lesson, we will see some who have wandered from the truth, again, that was alluded to during the sermon, proclaiming themselves to be prophets. Their messages were and are false. And we're going to talk about, a lot about that today in this second chapter of 2 Peter. We also know that there's a terrible punishment awaiting those who teach false doctrines, especially when their intention is to lead people away from the truth of God. God doesn't take kindly to that. He'll give them rope, as I'll mention as we get into this. But the rope only goes so far, and then God yanks on it. And they quit talking because they get squished. Peter describes false teachers in detail in this chapter so that Christians would always recognize their characteristics as well as their methods. And I think it's important to see both of those delineations, the characteristics of a false teacher, a false prophet, and the techniques that they use to lure people away. The greatest sin of Christ rejectors and the most damning work of Satan, I believe, is a misrepresentation of the truth and its consequent deception, because it causes people confusion. And I've been around church a long time, and one of the things that has probably frustrated me more than anything in my ministry, and I'm sure most other elders would feel the same way, is when you see somebody who crawls into the congregation and they've got the philosophy or different theology, and they start wanting to spread it around amongst other people to get people to believe like they do. They want the following. They want this crowd. And that's a pet peeve of mine when it comes to the ministry, because, I mean, we as ministers work so hard sometimes to be able to keep everybody on the right track, going down the right path, being encouraged, being positive about life, and then somebody else comes in and disrupts that. That's horrid. That's absolutely horrid. And I believe God and Jesus Christ feel that is just as horrid. And that has happened all through history. You go all the way back to the Old Testament, right in the beginning. It's including today as well. And that's one of the things that we're going to see here in 2 Peter. So let's begin in 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false prophets among you. He's talking about Old Testament versus now. Who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. Let's review this verse, because this verse is powerful. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you. Let's remember that there were false prophets of old, as we've seen in many Old Testament passages, including Zedekiah, which you might remember, Hananiah, both of these are found in Jeremiah, Jeremiah exposed about 5 or 6 of the false prophets of the Old Testament. I think he had an attitude toward them because he saw the destruction that was being done and he wanted to do something about it. Even as there were holy men of old of God speaking as they were moved by God's Holy Spirit, we're also seeing now in 2 Peter that false prophets and false teachers were there doing the same thing, trying to disrupt what the men of God were trying to keep together. Peter stated that this is a fact and not as a possibility. He said, this is real. This is happening now, and it's going to continue to happen. And he said, they were among you. That's what he said in that first verse. Not only on the outside of church, they were inside the church trying to do their destructive works and behavior. Clark Commentary had this to say about this subject. Let me read this. Quote, there were not only holy men of God among the Jews who prophesied by divine inspiration, but there were also false prophets whose prophecies were for their own imagination and perverted many. And these individuals, from their own imagination, these guys just created stuff. But I don't believe that personally. I believe what we're seeing, when we see false teachers, false prophets, what we're seeing is Satan at his best, utilizing human beings who are willing to acquiesce to that spirit, his Satan spirit trying to influence God's spirit and man's spirit in him to lead them away. That's the whole purpose of life for him, is destroy the people that he can't have. We next read in verse 1 as we go back, who secretly bring in destructive heresies. False teachers work secretly. They don't come right out and say, guess what I've got? I got something that's completely different than what you teach. No, they weave it in as carefully as they can, privately as they can. They'll work on people one-on-one. They'll invite them over to their house for dinner. I mean, we had a guy back where we came from, did this for years. He had a heretical bent on a personal thing about the truth of God. And what he would do is he would invite a couple, he and his wife, or an individual, have them over for dinner, gracious, feed them wine, you know, give them a nice meal, and slowly as the evening went on, just wove in this new philosophy, this new heresy, this new teaching. And many people bought into it because it's been presented in such a way that it sounds palatable. It sounds correct because Satan's really, really good at mixing truth with falsehood. It isn't their teaching is secret, but their deceptive nature of their teaching is what's hidden. They don't come out and say, well, I'm going to teach you something new and different that is different than what the church teaches. No false teacher ever announces himself as a false teacher because they don't think they're false. They think they're absolutely right on target and correct. False teachers also bring in destructive heresies, as we read, that destroy by telling lies about Jesus Christ and his work for us and his work in us. If you ever notice what some of these false teachings are, they're ways to destroy our relationship with Christ. They come from many different angles. And that's why Peter's trying to tell us, be aware that this kind of deception is really trying to weave something evil into something that's good. By these heresies, people are discouraged, as I mentioned earlier. They're hurt, and in some instances, they're destroyed spiritually. Because it's hard to recover from something like this if you allow it to come into your life. Heresy isn't a harmless effort on behalf of the perpetrators. They want something different to take place in the minds of the individuals they're working with. Let's look next in the verse. It says, even denying the Lord who bought them. False teachers deny the Lord who bought them. Jesus Christ paid for us with his own life. In this, Peter says that at the very least, they appear to us to be saved. And I think we read some part of that in 1 John. They give this an appearance of being righteous. They give this appearance of being converted and hearts are being right. But you got to wonder after a while, were they ever really truly converted? At the same time, they are false and they are destructive in their behavior. Hold your place here in 2 Peter 2 and flip with me over to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. I'm going to take a little longer on the first few verses here to really lay the groundwork for us. Here in Matthew 7, and we're going to read just one verse 15, we'll see a comment made by Jesus Christ about false teachers and false teachers and prophets. It fits right into what Peter's telling us here in 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. Just one verse, Matthew 7 and verse 15. Christ said, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. In other words, they come into our midst like they're one of us, one of the sheep. And that's intentional. They want to blend. They want to fit in. But in their hearts, Christ calls them a ravenous wolf, somebody that's trying to destroy the sheep. Even a person who appears what appears to be godly and live in a godly walk in relationship with Jesus Christ can still bring destructive business into the church and into the congregations. Destructive heresies. Oftentimes, those who appear as good men who teach lies do the worst damage. And again, I've had personal experience with this, where the individuals just come across as so smooth, so involved and so caring and so nurturing that they just lure you into a trap if you're willing to go that path. Their lies are accepted far more easily because they have an apparent good character. And this is problematic. And this is what Peter's trying to get us to see. You just can't take the look at somebody and say, well, they're a good person. Next in the verse we say, well, also what Jesus Christ told us, he said, by their fruits you shall know them. So once you get to talking with somebody like this and dealing with somebody like this, you'll start seeing, and God's Holy Spirit, I think, will start sending little flashes to you. Something's not right here. And if you ever get into a conversation like that where you feel something's not right, it's probably not. And I would suggest backing away from it and go to get some counsel from somebody else that can give you some advice about what you're being told or what's being discussed. But next in the verse, you see, they bring upon themselves swift destruction. False teachers are promised swift destruction, even though they aren't judged fast enough in the opinion of many. Me being one of them. It's probably a really good thing that I don't have the power of taking care of somebody that needs to be taken care of, because I would have taken care of some things a long time ago before I'd let it go as far as it did. But that's God's job. That's God's responsibility, not ours. We must always remember that God said about retribution, he said, vengeance is mine. And that's a hard thing to deal with sometimes for some of us and the personalities that we have, because we see the destruction taking place right before our very eyes, and we want to fix it. We always want to make it right. Okay, let's go back to 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 2 and now verse 2. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. Because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. This reminds us that false teachers may be popular. They may be prominent. They may be somebody that you just sort of look up to in your own way, because they create these relationships. They know how to create these bonds. I keep thinking about this one couple. It was so much subterfuge. They wanted to build the relationship with you, and then boom, they'd nail you. And it was really, really disruptive to see happen, and really disheartening. Just because something succeeds in attracting a crowd of followers, it doesn't mean that it is of God. We know that God's work will always bear positive fruit, but the devil's work can also increase. He knows how to make things look good. He's a master at that. Hold your place again here in 2 Peter and go to 2 Timothy 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Let's remember what Paul had to say on this subject here in 2 Timothy 4. As long as I've been in the church, what we are going to read has been a real problem. I mean, I can never remember a period of time when this that we're going to read right now hasn't been a problem within the Church of God. Let's begin in 2 Timothy 4 and verse 3. 2 Timothy 4, 3. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers. People get to the point they actually go looking for somebody teaching something different. They want to be different. They want to be unique. They want to be different than everybody else. And in verse 4, it said, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. Now, he's talking about people who actually are looking for stuff that's different, trying to find the loose brick, if you will. And they'll go today, with today's internet and the resources you have on the internet, you can find any kind of doctrine you want to look for. And you'll find people wanting to teach it, wanting to preach it, and wanting to get a following to go with it. False teachers have always been and always will be among Christians. It's just part of the thing. Jesus Christ called them weeds. You can't pull out all the weeds because then you'll start disrupting some of the actual good fruit. The most distressing fact is that so many Christians will follow these destructive ways. And it's the warning from Peter and the warning from Christ. When false teachers are at work and when crowds are following them, God's holy name and honor, I think, are disgraced. All right, let's go back to 2 Peter. And this whole concept of false doctrine, false teachings, false prophets is just a disgrace to God, and it's a smear on Jesus Christ's sacrifice. 2 Peter 2, verse 3. By covetousness, they will exploit you with destructive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. False teachers are covetousness. They use covetousness. Both their own and the followers, they actually appeal to the covetousness of the individuals they're talking to. Don't you want to know more than everybody else? Don't you want to be smarter than everybody else? Don't you want to be, like, more informed? Many false teachers, both today and in previous times, present a message that has self-gratification at its core. If they can get somebody else to believe them and follow them, it boosts their ego. And that's what they're after. They want an ego boost. All this is presented with quote-unquote deceptive words, like I mentioned. They know how to schmooze you up. That's Satan. That's Satan at his best. He knows how to bring you into the fold. Again, because false teaching never announces itself as such. In the statement, their judgment has not been idle and their destruction does not slumber, Peter assures us that false teachers will be judged. We may not be the means by that judgment coming about in our lifetime now, and it may not even be us who has to correct it, but we should be reassured that it's not going to be allowed to go on forever, and it will in fact be judged and it will in fact be corrected. And sometimes God will use human instruments to correct it, like a pastor of a church or an elder of the church or a deacon or even another member of the church to help bring something like that to the fore. But it's not necessarily always our responsibility. Even though it seems like they prosper, Peter's telling us their judgment is not idle. It's not going to not happen. God's wrath pours out on them even in allowing them to continue, thus heaping up more and more condemnation and hardness of heart in themselves. And when the anvil finally comes crashing down, it's going to be a painful, painful response from them. God knows how to take care of both the righteous, as we've seen and heard, as well as the ungodly. He's got everything under control. And he wants us to have the reassurance that that control is something that he is going to maintain throughout. All right, let's continue on in verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, referring to the fact that these ungodly behaviors are not going to go unjudged, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, can then condemn them to destruction, making them an example to those afterward who live ungodly. Peter uses three events in history of the past to make the point of the retribution coming to false teaching, false indoctrination, and false behavior. And he's pointing out three really dramatic events in human history: the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, and what was the third one? Oh, the angels, yeah. I mean, he took these three major, major examples. God judged those wicked angels and Satan way back when, setting them in chains of darkness. Now, that's their ultimate position to be in. They're in chains of darkness now only because they're limited about what they can do and what they can't do. God allows things that for them to do, but he circumvents others. The fallen angels, now called demons, had the opportunity to follow God and his plan. But instead, they chose to follow the original false prophet and false teacher, Satan himself. If you think about it, that's where that's what it takes us all the way back to. The false teaching, false doctrine, false approach to things, it was Satan that started all that. That event can be researched more if you choose to in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. I'm not going to go into that because of time here. It talks about the fallen Satan and how the demons all came about. Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. But it's an incredible part of biblical history. In the statement that we just read, it said, cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness. We see the response of God to their rebellion. Eventually, God puts a stop to it completely. This is going to be their ultimate fate before the final destruction at the end of this age. They still can come and go now. They still have means to go about the earth, do whatever they want to do. They're not in the chains of casting down into hell yet. That's going to happen when Jesus Christ returns, as we know, for the 1,000 years. And that's when they're really going to go nuts. I mean, because they're going crazy right now. And I really believe because Satan, he knows that he's got a shortened time. I mean, every day that goes by, time is shorter. Now, I don't know how much time we have left, but it's one day less than it was yesterday. Satan knows this. And we were told biblically that when Satan realizes this, he gets more and more angry. And I believe what we're seeing is some of that anger being expressed in the world around us. When you see some of the behavior of some of the human beings, even in our government's administration, it's mind-boggling how evil the comments are and how evil the motivation is coming from these individuals. This is Satan running rampant, using other human beings to accomplish his goal. And the comment, cast them down into hell, is the temporary punishment when Jesus Christ returns and they and Satan are bound for this 1,000 years. The ancient Greek word translated hell here is literally Tartarus, T-A-R-T-A-R-U-S. In Greek mythology, Tartarus was the lowest of hell, a place of punishment for rebellious gods. And it's interesting that Peter chose to use this analogy in talking about the destination of the demons and Satan himself in a place of punishment for these angels who have sinned. Hold your place again here. Go back to Genesis 6. Genesis chapter 6. Genesis 6. The next example that Peter used was the Noachian flood as his next analogy, and we'll see why God destroyed all living here on the earth in Genesis 6. God will allow a lot of rope to be extended before he finally responds, and when he responds, it's not pretty. Let's see what I mean. Genesis 6, and again, just one verse, verse 5. God judged the ancient world, the world before Noah's flood, because, verse 5, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. It's hard to comprehend that, but I think we're watching it happen again. It is evolving. I don't know if it'll ever get to a completeness of this, but we're seeing this evil in the thoughts and the hearts of men. It's gone rampant now. This evil thinking and behaving has been going on since the dawn of man. He next brings up the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, doesn't he? God judged the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, making them an example of his judgment. Because of the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, it was great, and because their sin was very grave. You can reference that in Genesis 18 and verse 20. I'm not going to turn there if you'd like to see more specifically about this. So these three examples of judgment show us the important principle that Peter wants to highlight. One, God judged the angels who sinned to show no one is too high to be judged. God judged the ancient world before the flood to show God doesn't grade on a curve. Disobedience has a price, no matter what, no matter how it's going about. and God judged Sodom and Gomorrah to show even the prosperous are going to be judged. These were two pronounced cities, and they were destroyed. Therefore, the ungodly have no reason to think that they can escape God's judgment. Their coming judgment is certain. Back to 2 Peter. Now for some good news. 2 Peter 2, verse 7. And he delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of the temptations and to reserve the unjust unto punishment for the day of judgment. Peter already told us that the Lord delivered Noah. Now he shows us that the Lord delivered righteous Lot as well. If there's anybody worth delivering, God's going to deliver them. If there's anybody trying to live God's way of life, of righteousness, God will deliver them. Again, Clark's commentary puts it this way about this point. The preservation and deliverance of Lot gave the apostle occasion to remark that God knew as well to save as to destroy, and that his goodness led him as forcibly to save righteous Lot as his justice did to destroy the rebellious in the instances already presented. God saves those who should be saved, and God destroys those who should be destroyed. The story of Lot is very sad, but God still saw him as righteous and saved him and his family, sort of, if you know the rest of the story. Even as the Lord delivered Lot, he knows how to deliver us. He says, talks about it in 2 Peter here, delivers us from temptations and the challenges that we face. And I think one of the reassurances that we can take from this comment like this is that no matter what we're going through, no matter what we're facing, God will deliver us out of this somehow, some way. He'll give us the way of escape. And we need to tell ourselves that. We need to reassure ourselves that and remember that that's going to take place. He also knows how to reserve the unjust for the day of judgment. And we need to just rest at peace knowing that the unjust will be taken care of by God when the time is right. We can trust in God's deliverance of the godly because it is just as certain as the judgment of the ungodly. Then Peter goes back to discussing the ungodly in verse 10. And especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. They are presumptuous, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries. Whereas angels, who are greater in power and might, do not bring a reviling accusation against them before the Lord. These ungodly individuals are especially reserved for judgment because this is so prevalent in humanity today. And I'm sorry to acknowledge it's so prevalent even within God's church. People are willing to speak evil of other individuals. He's talking about dignitaries here, but I mean, people are willing to complain and criticize anything and anybody. It's like there's no fear. They live according to the flesh, not according to the spirit, and are marked by uncleanness. Peter shows that these ungodly ones are proud, and they despise authority. And I don't know if you've ever dealt with any individuals, again, within the church, because he's primarily talking to people who are converted. He wants them to stay that way. You can't despise authority and mock it and degrade it and criticize it and think that that's okay. It's just not. In their presumption, they will even speak ill of spiritual powers and that the angels themselves do not speak evil of. Apparently, the angels won't even speak evil of Satan himself, the epitome of evil, because they had this respect for this authority. I mean, Satan was once Lucifer, one of the kingpins. And they probably remember that. But these types of people are not afraid to speak evil of anyone or anything. They just go at it. And I've personally witnessed, and I'm sure some of you have, some really vicious attacks on other human beings. Here Peter contrasted the behavior of those who walk according to the flesh with angels, that is, faithful angels. The faithful angels did not slander or exaggerate in or what they said or how they responded to the sins of others. These who walked according to the flesh did. So when the angels go and report to God, maybe your guardian angel, I actually personally believe this is not a church doctrine or anything like this. I really believe that we have a guardian angel. I mean, I think I can prove that biblically speaking, but that's arguable. But when your angel or when an angel goes and reports to God and Jesus Christ sitting on their thrones about your behavior, because the Bible's laced with that's what happens. They come and go, and they're reporting. Apparently, they don't rile against you. They don't rant and rave and call you names and belittle you and berate you. They just present the facts and that let it be at that. That's the way we should start looking at things. The faithful angels did not slander or exaggerate in anything they did. There is bad news in their future as well as we will see next, beginning in verse 12. Let's look on. But these individuals, these false teachers and false behavior, like natural brute beasts made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil of the things they do not understand and will utterly perish in their own corruption and will receive the wages of unrighteousness as those who count it pleasure to a crowd carouse in the daytime. Let's stop there and read the remainder in a moment. Since the function of the flesh, not of the spirit, they function of the flesh, not of the spirit. Peter's saying they're like animals. That's how he's equating this kind of behavior. They're only fit for destruction, made to be caught and destroyed, as he put it. And they are ignorant. Now, if you were to tell somebody this, it wouldn't sit too well with them, I'm sure. The ungodly will be paid for their evil, and their fleshly lives will be paid with the right wages of unrighteousness. Barclay's commentary has this to say about this passage. Quote, what these evil men who were troubling Peter's people were doing was to say that they loved and served Christ while the things they taught and did were in complete denial of him. Again, what did Christ say? By their fruits you will know them. And when we see this unrighteous fruit and behavior coming out of somebody, you've got to question where it's coming from. Because the Bible tells us it's not of God. And if it's not of God, what is it of? There's only one other option. Verse 13, the last half of verse 13 now. Peter says, they are spots, like welts. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions while they feast with you. These ungodly false teachers are a dangerous and corrupting presence in the body of Christ. Not only deceiving others, but deceiving themselves as well. And he's talking about them while they feast with you. We've actually fellowshipped, possibly, at a feast day with individuals with this kind of behavior planted in their hearts and in their minds. Verse 14, having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. They have a heart trained in covetousness, covetous practices, and are cursed children. This is a really condemning essay. Their heart is set on the flesh and their eyes on adultery, both spiritual and sexual. They prey on the unstable to join them in their deceptive ways of deception. They are equipped, but not for ministry, only for selfish gain. They are truly, as Peter put it, accursed. These types of people are despised by God and Jesus Christ. We all train our hearts in something. And this is an important point right here that I'm going to discuss. Either training them in covetousness in our lives or in godliness. According to Clark's commentary, the term, they have a heart trained in covetous practices, has a very interesting origin. Listen to this. The metaphor is taken from the agonista in the Grecian games, who exercise themselves in those feats such as wrestling, boxing, running, etc., in which they propose to contend in public games. These persons had their hearts schooled in nefarious practices. They had exercised themselves until they were perfectly expert in all the arts of seduction, overreaching, and every kind of fraud. These people's minds and hearts have been warped. And I believe some of them don't even really fully comprehend and understand the nastiness and the evil that is coming from within them, because they have trained their hearts to be like this. How does one train your heart? It's by what you do, what you think, what you read, what you practice, what you absorb yourself, what just fully, completely absorbs you in life. It's a scary description of anybody. Verse 15, they have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but he was rebuked for his iniquity. A dumb donkey, speaking with a man's voice, restrained the madness of the prophet. He points out they're like Balaam, who is guilty of the greatest sins, leading others into sin. And that for the sake of his own gain. And you see this as a theme among these false teachers and false prophets. Balaam had to be restrained by a dumb donkey. I like the way the King James puts it, to be honest with you. Because he would not listen to God. Verse 17. These are wells without water, clouds carried by a tempest, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. These ungodly false teachers are actually empty. They're basically, Paul Peter's trying to tell us, they're basically worthless entities in life. As useless as a well without water. We just watched a movie the other day, I think it was Sahara. Is that the one that we saw? Where they're out in the middle of the desert and these Bedouins were out there. And one of the problems they had this beautiful well that was drilled. It was like maybe 100 feet deep. You know what was at the bottom of the well? Sand. Well like that doesn't do you much good, does it? It's worthless. That's what Peter's trying to tell us. And like clouds that only bring darkness, but no nourishing rain. Sort of like Tucson. You have these hopeful these hopeful clouds developing, and you get nada. Just joking. Okay, let's continue in verse 18. For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, their techniques, through lewdness, technique, the ones who have actually escaped from these who live in error. The message of the ungodly false teachers is empty of any real spiritual content. It's hollow. It's meaningless. Though it is swollen with big words, big promises, big hopes, big ideas, big differences, their allure is to the lusts of the flesh in their audience, just as the crowds who wanted bread from Jesus but didn't want anything to do with Christ himself. They want what they've got to offer, but they don't want to put in the time. They don't want to make it change their lives. Verse 19, while they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage. As Peter points out, they promise freedom, but freedom can never be found in the flesh. Freedom can only be found in God's Spirit. That's where true freedom comes in the lives that we are living. Freedom isn't found what Jesus can give us, but only in following Jesus Christ and his teachings. It's not something we're going to get necessarily. Now, sometimes we do get good, positive things. God and Christ want to bless us, but they want to see a right purpose and a right reason for that blessing. He also shows us that in being overcome by the flesh and the false teachers, these unfortunate individuals unfortunately become slaves to both, and they find themselves enslaved all over again in life. Okay, just a few more verses. Verse 20. Now Peter sums up the danger of falling away to following after false teachers. Verse 20. For if, after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the latter end is worse for them than the beginning. It is better for a person to have never known a thing about Jesus than to hear some truth, hold on to it for a while, and then later reject it and abandon it. Clark's commentary again has something interesting to say about this point. Quote, "Their end is worse than the beginning, because they have returned to the pollutions of the world. These pollutions are called miasmata, things that infect, pollute, and defile." And then he quotes St. Augustine. He's saying St. Augustine has improved on this image. "The whole world," says he, "is one great diseased man, lying extended from east to west and from north to south. And to heal this great sick man, the Almighty Physician descended from heaven." Peter then continues on this thought in verse 21. "For it would have been better for them to not have known the way of righteousness than, having known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them." Peter certainly described a picture that definitely has the appearance of people losing out on their salvation if they continue to follow this way of life. But let me add this. That doesn't mean that somebody can come into God's truth, fall away for a period of time, and then God bring him back into the fold. I'm a living example of that. And I know several other people who are in the same boat. We got our feelings hurt. We got offended. We got felt like we were rejected, so we went our own way for a while. But then when God wants to bring you back, you get a 2x4 between the eyes. And it's not a pleasant ordeal. Because if he's not finished with you, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't run like Jonah tried to. And you can't hide. But if somebody truly does reject God, reject God's way of life, and never ever comes back to it, you're saying it couldn't have a worse ending. Debunking the thought of once saved, always saved. Then he gets really descriptive. Verse 22. "But it has happened to them according to the true proverb." Then he quotes Proverbs. "A dog returns to its own vomit, and a sow having washed to for her own wallowing in the mire." This disgusting nature of dogs is displayed by the way it returns to its vomit. Regretfully, if you've ever owned a dog, you've probably witnessed this. And it is disgusting. Lily, don't do that. Fudgy, don't do that. It's disgusting. Peter is showing us that it's just as disgusting for someone to have abandoned their corruption of the world, being called by God, repented, gotten baptized, received God's Spirit, and then return to God's way of life, and then abandon God's truth and go right back to the sewage of the world. He's saying it's just like a dog going back to its vomit. I love how William Barclay puts it from one of his commentaries. "Peter ends with contempt. These evil men are like dogs who return to their vomit, or like a sow who has been scrubbed and goes back and rolling in the mud. They have seen Christ, but are so morally degraded by their own choice that they prefer to wallow in the depths of sin rather than to climb to the heights of virtue. It is a dreadful warning that a man can make himself such that in the end, the tentacles of sin are inextricably around him, and virtue for him has lost its beauty." The end. Any thoughts, comments, or questions? This is a pretty brutal chapter of the Bible when it comes to talking about delineating righteousness from ungodliness and what God's intending to do with the ungodly. And he equates this primarily to false teachers and false prophets who then lead people astray. That is an evil that God himself absolutely despises. And he hates it. And Proverbs 6 tells us that he hates it. Yes, Steve. The dating of this?
Yeah.
I forget what the original dating was when we first started. Do you recall?
About 64, 65.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I was going to say early to mid-60s.
Maybe 67 for the second book. 67 yeah. Is what I
gave. Yeah, because
it was written significantly for 3rd John.
Yes.
John was written about 90, so this was...
Yes, it was written probably 20 years before, at least.
Before.
Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be a pretty safe assumption. Mr. Bianchi.
the scriptures that says they would have been better off if they had not known the truth than know the truth and get caught afterwards. Reminds of the parable that Christ was saying, I don't want them to know. That's why I'm talking like this. Right. I want to save them. I want to be innocent.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why he used parables. He said he doesn't want everybody to be getting the messages right now. It's not time for them. God the Father will determine when that takes place, or each individual. Yes, Joe.
It's amazing here when I'm looking at verse 4, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned but cast them down to hell, they had the truth at the start, and how somehow they got away from it.
You know how? The first false preacher, the first false prophet, Satan himself, the father of deception.
Yep.
And he was so good at it, and I'm glad you brought that point up because that's a very valid point. He's so good at it, he took these angels that knew the truth of God, the plan of God, and was able to convince them to follow him. That should send a message to us. Nobody
is a lot of power.
Power. Incredible power. Nasty power. Sam, get a microphone to Sam.
How powerful was Satan?
As powerful as God allowed him to be.
Was he the second, third, fourth power in heaven?
Well, when the angels are first created, if you go back to Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, you start seeing that he was sort of the preeminent one. He was number one of the three. Satan, Michael, and
Gabriel.
Age.
So, he was a very powerful angel. But what overtook him was...
Pride.
Pride?
Again, I would encourage you to...
I was thinking more of vanity.
Vanity, pride, I mean, it all comes into play. That's all interchangeable.
Huh? Well, I just said, I'm just looking at it that way. Vanity is vanity.
But, again, I would encourage you to read Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. I mean, it really starts filling in a lot of bits and pieces of the puzzle.
I'm just kidding.
Okay, anybody else? Any other comments? Without further... Oh, Mr. Bianchi, one more time.
Thousands and millions of people go to church on the day of the sun. Mm-hmm. And who's teaching them? The false ministers. And yet they went to seminary school, and they surely come across the Ten Commandments, the day of the Sabbath, and yet they walk out of there and they want to preach on Sunday, the day of the sun. Just think, we keep the Saturnalia. Isn't that nice?
Well, there's one easy answer to that kind of response, and I've had to tell people this all through my ministry. They haven't been called of God. They have blinders on them. They're not going to be held responsible for that until God finally calls them. God's basically given them an excuse. And they've been led astray because they followed the teachings of the world around them. If God blinds us, and we know that that's the case because Christ told us that, they've got blinders on them. They can't see the truth. You could tell it to them. You could show it word for word, and they still won't get it. Until God the Father says, I want you.
That's true for the people who listen, but what's in it for the men who are doing the false teaching? They went to school. They should know.
They don't know any better, Ray. They don't know any better. They went to school being taught by people who don't know any better either.
Well, that goes back to the hundreds of years. The false teaching, generation after generation after generation.
Right. It's been going on since man was put on this earth. It started in the Garden of Eden with a father of deception. A father of deception caused chaos among humanity, and it's been going on for 6,000 years. The only way that gets fixed at the present time is if God chooses to call an individual and they respond to the calling. But until God chooses to call them, they don't have a chance. They can't understand it. It's an impossibility. Anybody else? Comments, questions, thoughts? Mr. Buchanan, you have the floor.